I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Hello, and welcome back to this week's episode of Desert Island Dishes with me, Margie Broadhead. My guest this week is the wonderful Frances Quinn, winner of the Great British Bake Off Series 4. Now, like most people in the UK and probably the world, I'm fairly obsessed with the Great British Bake Off, and it's back on telly next week. So to meet a winner was just a dream come true. Frances is ridiculously talented. She sees food in a way that just most people don't, and yet it just comes so naturally to her. Have a look at her Instagram if you haven't already, because it will boggle your mind. In a good way. She makes the most incredible cakes that all look almost too good to eat. Almost. So it was genuinely just lovely to meet Fran and have a chat about all things Bake Off. I wanted all the goss, as well as all the amazing things she's been up to since the show. We recorded this sitting in my car. Oh, the glamour. And you see some pretty strange things sitting in a parked car for 40 minutes, let me tell you. Anyway, here is Frances. I am very honoured to be here today with Frances, who is not only a Great British Bake Off winner, but also the holder of 2 world records. Welcome, Frances. So, Frances, take us back to before the Bake Off. What were you up to?
So I was a designer before going on the Bake Off, although it's funny, I shouldn't say I was, because I sort of still see I am, but I'm just, rather than designing with fabric, I'm designing with food. So, yeah, I was a baby toddler designer for Jules. And it was the people at Jules that sort of encouraged me to apply for the show.
I was going to say, what made you want to apply? Was it just you loved baking and everyone was
I did love baking, but it really took on a more creative angle when I joined Jules, because they were wanting someone to be putting recipes on the blog. So they were like, oh, Fran, you often talk about baking. Why don't you, you know, do some recipes? So I started doing that. And then I just started doing bakes for people's birthdays or selection meetings. So say if we were designing a spring summer collection, that's when I did like the edible biscuit beach. And it was for a lot of the bakes I did on Bake Off started life at Jules. So the giant jam sandwich cake, that was done for my friend Hannah. And the secret squirrel cake was done for my friend and colleague Susie, because her nickname was Squirrel. And she was pregnant, so everyone was calling the bump the secret squirrel. So the day before she left work for maternity leave, I created the cake. And I remember thinking, because Susie was all, she always used to eat loads of nuts and stuff, obviously, pre-pregnancy. So I sort of wanted it to be like a tree with nuts. I didn't completely know what I was going to be, if it was going to work. But I remember the night before making it, I was like, well, I really want to fit a squirrel in the cake, but it might end up looking like the Turin Shroud. So I fitted it in. And then I remember walking up the stairs at work and I was like, it's a tree cake, it's a tree. And I was like, well, there should be something hidden inside. And then I remember Susie cut through it and it did, it thankfully looked like a squirrel. And then for weeks after, everyone was like, how did you get a squirrel inside
people
a cake?
People must have been blown away. I mean, like gobsmacked.
So they were the ones that were like, Fran, you need to go on the show. So they were lining up application forms by my desk, and so I applied quite late, but yeah, it's all down to them.
Well, and so how do you actually apply? What does it consist of?
It is a long process.
Oh,
it's almost as long as the filming for the show.
Oh, really? Well, just because of the sheer number of applicants.
Yeah. And I think all the different stages. So once you apply, the form itself is really long. It's about 4 or 5 pages long. And then
what do they want to know?
So they want to know like how confident you are with, like, because obviously it's not just cake, it's cake, biscuits, bread, pastry, how you feel about them all. I think they're trying to work out that you haven't got a little patisserie shop down the road and you are actually an amateur.
Never done this before.
Exactly. Shoe pastry, what? And then I remember the first time I got a call on my mobile, obviously it was like an unknown number, and I was like, hello? And they were like, this is the Great British Bake Off. And I was like, And I remember I got it at work, so I like scuttled down into like the corridor, and I then remember taking all my phone interviews in the disabled toilets at work, because it was the only place that you had privacy. I'd be in there for about 10 or 15 minutes.
Oh my God.
I remember like colleagues were like, are you okay, Fran? So I had about 3 phone interviews before then I got the phone interview saying, you've made it through to like the auditions in London. And I remember it was the night of the Christmas party, so I had a real reason to celebrate.
Oh my goodness.
And then, yeah, then I had to come down to London and you had to take a sweet and savoury bake.
What did you take?
Well, you have to think of something that's going to travel well.
Yeah.
That's definitely the technical challenge. Yeah. So I did
the first one
without a red gingham tablecloth anywhere in sight. So I, one of the cakes that everyone loved at work was like my apple crumble and custard cake. So it was like an apple cake and then it had custard running through it and then a crumble top. And it was quite good to travel with because it was sort of flat.
Yeah.
And then I sort of pushed the boat out a little bit more for the savoury. So I did a twist on the Scotch egg. So it was like using chicken mince rather than pork to play on the whole thing. What came first, the chicken or the egg?
Oh, I love
crazy.
That.
I'm bad for a pun. Bad for a pun. And then it had like a pastry shell rather than like a sort of...
Breadcrumb.
And then it was sat on a nest of cheese straws.
Oh my goodness.
So I had to assemble it in there. And honestly, the place where we had the audition, it was almost like what I described like as a baker's waiting room. So obviously all the other bakers were in there and we were just sitting there and we were putting our bakes up. But most people were like, just sat their cake on. I was like, hang on, I've just got to assemble the edible nest. And I think that was when they were like, oh, what have we got?
Other people must have been eyeing you up like, oh my goodness, why have I bought a Victoria's Sponge?
No, there were some amazing creations, absolutely amazing. So you had that, you then had to meet the producers, had a bit of a screen test to make sure you didn't sort of clam up in front of the camera. And I had what I sort of was like my baking portfolio, because I was a designer. I had like a design one and I used to take loads of photos of the bakes when I used to take them into work. It was always a running joke, actually, that I used to take a bake in and I'd be like, hang on, guys, let me just take a photo of it. And there was an amazing like design room that just had a nice big white table, so I was able to take a photo. So that all sort of just got produced into a portfolio. So I remember one of the producers were like, we've never had a baking portfolio before. And also, I'd done a cake for one of my colleagues at work. She wanted a cake for her family friend called the Pigeons.
Oh my goodness.
They love pigeons. So I did a pigeon cake with edible pigeon poo on the side, as you do.
What was the poo made out of?
It was just like water icing. But I'd printed out a sheet of like paving slab, so it looked a bit more.
Oh my goodness. So you were able to show them that and they were just like, that. You are in.
And the producer, an unusual bird to like, but she was a big fan of pigeons. So it was really? Quite, she was like,
really?
I'm always going to remember you.
I have so many questions, but let's take a pause there and talk about your first desert island dish of the day. And that is the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
Oh, you see, I'm the youngest of 5. So food was always a big thing anyway. But you know what? It might be as simple as either a boiled egg and soldiers on a Sunday or something like ready breck. I've moved on to porridge, making my own now, but I still, you know, there's something about ready breck.
Yeah, just occasionally. The ready breckers.
Or flapjacks. There's definitely an oat theme going on here.
Yeah, yeah. Those are great options.
Or shepherd's pie.
Yeah.
I mean, I can never choose one, sorry.
That's okay. Those are all lovely home comforts.
Yeah, sort of home.
And was your mum a good cook?
She was. I mean, she sort of had to bake for like a family of 7, but she much prefers gardening.
Okay.
So I think she quite likes it now that if I come round, I'll sort of be like, don't worry, mum.
You take over.
I'll look after
Christmas
that.
Is on
yeah,
you.
Yeah, exactly.
So right, back to the goss. How far in advance does it get filmed? And winning is obviously an enormous deal. How hard was it to keep that a secret?
It was tough. Yeah, I always say, if all the baking fails, MI5 beckons.
Yeah. Yes.
It shows I can keep the secret.
Oh my goodness, I'd just be the worst.
I think it's sort of, you obviously have to sign confidentiality forms, but we started filming in the April, and then obviously it was 10 weeks to get up to the final.
Yeah.
So the final was in the June, and then the first episode gets broadcast at the end of August, but the final, as you guys see it, is in October. So it's 4 months between me winning and everyone else knowing I've won.
Oh my goodness.
And the 2 months between it finishing and it starting to be broadcast, that is just a real head head spin.
So strange.
Because I remember going back to work the Monday after I'd won, sitting there answering emails like the vending machine's not working, the, you know, the children's garments are coming in for the selection meeting next week, and just not quite being able to focus or concentrate.
Hello, I'm a GBO winner.
But no one cared. No one cared at that point. And then when the first episode went out, that's suddenly when your name and your face is released to like the media. And then I was walking around town, everyone's like, Secret Squirrel Woman. So you know who wins, and you know when you go out, and you're like,
Secret, that's what I got known as.
I was like, and I literally did have to keep the secret. So that cake was more iconic and symbolic in more ways.
And once you won and the show aired and the secret was out, how did life change? Was it a crazy whirlwind?
It was a complete whirlwind. You were like strapped in. It was just... It was manic. I remember the 48 hours following me winning. I was literally being sort of like driven around from radio station to show. I remember the morning like chatting to like Nick Grimshaw and Chris Evans. And then later on, I was on the one show, sat next to Joan Collins and just thinking, I can't even like figure this out.
No.
But you don't really get a minute to stop, which is probably a good thing.
And do they prepare you?
Really? No,
I guess it's hard to prepare for that kind of thing.
Yeah, so. There is no book. There's no manual. So, yeah.
And who did you watch the final with? And what was that like actually watching
So I watched it because I had to be in London just for all the press and media stuff. So I stayed at my cousin's flat in Angel, where I had been living anyway before going to Jules. And we just had friends and family, loads of emergency chairs round.
Oh.
I remember because obviously that's when it was suddenly people, the final. And I remember walking back from supermarket with like provisions and stuff and people already sort of clocking your face a little bit.
Oh my goodness.
And I remember we had loads of like pretzels in because that was the technical bake that evening for the bake-off. But I stood throughout, even though we had loads of emergency chairs, because you didn't get to see how every episode was going to be edited.
Yeah.
So each week, I used to find it really quite traumatic. And there was even a bit of me going, maybe they shot several endings. Maybe it's like EastEnders and I haven't actually won.
Can you imagine?
I remember the producers when I was chatting to them in the week running up to it, because they were really good, just saying, you know. And they were like, Fran, your face is just a picture. And I was like, I remember every emotion just leaving my body because it was just such an emotional day. And I think if Ruby hadn't been standing there, I would have full-on fainted when they said my name.
Goodness.
I literally looked as white as flour. And then they thrust the trophy and flowers into my hands. I think I would have dropped them. So
it's just amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, moving on to your second Desert Island dish of the day. What is the first dish that you learnt to cook?
It was probably flapjacks. Yeah, probably flapjacks. I remember Sunday afternoons just going into the kitchen, and it was almost like an extension of the living room. Like I never felt intimidated in there. So if I just wanted to bake, I could. And because of having loads of brothers and sisters, it was like, well, nothing's going to go to waste.
Yeah.
And they're just such a great staple bake.
Yeah.
You know, one pan, bit of syrup, bit of butter. I now like to grate like orange or lemon zest in, which helps sort of cut through the sweetness a bit.
Yum. But
yeah, they're great.
But I actually find flapjacks quite hard to cook because when they come out, they're still so squidgy. It's a really hard
gauge.
Oh, is it going to solidify? And I've definitely been ones that have been like hard as rock when I've got it wrong.
I know, but then they're quite good as granola.
That's true.
And raw flapjack, though, to be honest,
before you put it in
doesn't
the oven,
even reach the tin.
God, no, I know. It's so good,
it's
isn't
so,
it?
So good.
No, it's so good. Like a delicious.
And my mum was really known for, like, one of my brother's friends used to call our house flapjack heaven.
Oh.
But we always joke at home now, like, we don't know what's gone. Something's gone awry with the flapjacks because they're not as we remember them.
Oh, no.
And I've been really like, Mum, have you changed the recipe? Are they in there for longer? She was like, oh, I don't know, Fran. Just wanted to get out in the garden.
Okay.
I'm like, no, Mum, we need to work out what's happened to the flapjack recipe.
We're going to lose our title.
Exactly. But no, flapjacks are always good.
Flapjack, that's a very good choice. So everybody loves Bake Off so much. But I do think it was the year that you were on it that people really loved it. And it sort of took off and became this proper phenomenon.
That word.
Did you anticipate that?
Not really, no. I mean, it's funny because we were the last year on BBC Two before it went over to One, but just because of the popularity of it. I remember they said that the final was the most viewed show on Two like overtaking Top Gear. It was like cake versus cars.
Oh my goodness.
And I remember one of my friends saying to me, she was like, Fran, I really don't think it's that big. I don't think you'll be recognised or anything. And then she goes now like, oh my Lord, like you're on the cover of the Radio Times. You're then on the cover of the Times the day after you won. It literally was like a media. It just kept on ramping up every week. And I think because we were an all female final and there was so much controversy around it, it was mad.
Yeah. And the actual practicalities of the filming, is it really filmed over the course of a weekend?
Yes, indeed. Okay. It is. And everyone, I think that's why everyone says, why do you wear the same clothes? Yeah. Because everyone knows it's like 2 days. We thankfully got to change our aprons because they look like a Jackson Pollock painting.
But why do they make you wear the same clothes?
Well, you're not meant to say, but it's do an edit. No, don't worry.
Oh, okay.
I think I'm out of the 1 year contractual thing. You're not meant to say a word.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, it is. There's no cheating on time. I wish we did have more time.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I have never known pressure or stress levels like it.
No.
A time and fridge space were the enemy. And yeah, when sometimes like Mel and Sue would be like, 2 hours to go when we only had 20 minutes, just so they had lots of different takes so they could use for the edit.
Okay.
So you were constantly like, you felt like you're in a TARDIS. You're like, how long have we got?
I mean, yeah.
How long have we got?
That's a bit disconcerting.
Yeah, 10 minutes since you last asked, Frances. And it was really weird just baking in a tent.
Yeah, really
because
weird.
We were at the mercy of the elements. Like, I remember like watching the weather that morning. Like we'd start filming at 7, so we'd have like a wake-up call at 5.
Ooh.
And watching like BBC weather and they'd be like, yeah, highs of 27. And we're like, we're meant to be making pastry.
Oh, yeah.
So, and then making meringue when it was like pouring down with rain.
I actually remember that one. The rain was so heavy.
It was just literally biblical.
Yeah.
And the floor was like a bouncy castle. I remember when we were doing egg custard tarts, like everyone was trying to put their egg custard tarts in the oven. And the custard mixture, it was like Jurassic Park. And everyone was like, can everyone? The cameramen are just running around because there's so many people in that tent.
Yeah,
so many people.
I want to know everything. But moving on to the third Desert Island dish of the day, what is the best dish you've ever eaten?
Well, again, you see, I'm never going to come up with just one option. Right. I fell in love with sushi when I went over to Vancouver because my sister lives there and I spent a year living and working there. And
amazing.
Oh my gosh, it's on every street corner. And there was an amazing place called the Sushi Eatery, which is a bit sort of like sushi with a definite twist.
Okay.
And I remember my sister was like, we can't go there first, Fran, because otherwise you are just going to think that sushi is always called like, there's sushi rolls called the Fat Elvis and whatever else.
Very Japanese.
And then also over in Vancouver, cinnamon buns, which are my favourite bake, hands down. And there was an amazing Jewish bakery over there called Solly's, and they did the most incredible cinnamon buns. So whenever I go over there now, I'm like, within 24 hours of landing, I'm like, we need to go to Solly's.
Cinnamon buns.
So cinnamon buns, sushi, and then cakes, Ottolenghi's apple and olive oil cake.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's from his first book. And I remember my cousin making it and just like, and it has like this incredible maple frosting. Oh, yeah, there's a few, but I think memories of food are also tied in with where you were and just experiences.
Definitely.
As well.
But so, no, that's really nice that you focused in on Vancouver.
Yeah.
How aware are you that you're on TV? Is that something that you get used to really quickly?
No, and I think because, I mean, we're always very glad it wasn't going out live. So we could, it wasn't really in our psyche how big it was going to get at the time. I mean, you're definitely aware of the amount of cameras and you're being interviewed about 8 times a day. And so if things go wrong, it's not like you can forget about it. You're being asked about it 24/7.
Talk us through that, Frances.
Talk us through that emotional, like, biscuit tower collapse. And you have to be quite good, which I didn't really master until about the semi-finals. Even then it was a bit of a challenge when the cameraman or producer asks you a question, but you can't just give the answer. You have to then put the question back in your answer. So say if they say, you're really stressed right now, you can't just go, yes. You got to go, yes, I'm really feeling quite stressed right now.
That's interesting.
But like I said, you didn't really get to see how the show was being edited. And it was because there's so much drama and commotion going on in the tent. It was actually quite interesting watching it back because you're like, oh, I didn't know that's what was going on when Howard was at his workbench doing that. So even things like Custard Gate, which happened in our year.
Did that pass you by?
That passed me by. Completely passed me by. I was at the front of the tent. That was all happening behind. Yeah, you wanted to be at the bench at the back. because that way, particularly for a technical challenge.
Oh my God, definitely. Being at the front is such a disadvantage.
Yeah, you could get to see what everyone was doing and you weren't meant to be looking behind your shoulder. So it was literally like being in an exam room, but you had a bit more of that. Or they're putting it in the oven now.
I always wondered that because, yeah, there is a lot of looking over the shoulder.
A lot of looking over the shoulder, and they move your benches around so you're never in the same space. So you also had a different coloured KitchenAid as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The feeling when you're waiting for the judges to go round and taste everyone's food.
Ugh.
How stressful was that? And how long are you actually waiting? Because I can imagine it felt
forever.
Like forever.
It's known as the Royal Tour. Well, the Royal Tour is when Mary and Paul come in and go round to your workbenches and go, so what are you baking this week? But the actual judging, so we probably come out of the tent. And then there is something known as the beauty shot, where they take your bake, put it at the end of the bench. They then call you in individually and you're to sit there with your apron and you're meant to stare lovingly at the bake.
Oh, yes.
And the camera pans back and forth on this very sort of, you know, technical device. That takes half an hour. So if you've created a bake that hasn't necessarily turned out that great, it is so traumatic looking at it for half an hour. And also, if it's really hot and say you've done spun sugar, that spun sugar is just collapsing.
Oh my God,
by
yeah.
the minute. So Mary and Paul don't actually get to taste it for about 2 hours. And then you've got to be in for that. So it is laborious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting because, yeah, all of those things that you wouldn't necessarily think of watching it. You're just like, oh, that's a nice shot of Frances staring at her cake.
Yeah, looking dead.
Yeah.
Looking dead. And everyone's like, do you get hair and makeup done? I'm like, no, 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 no.
Mary
and
Paul,
no, we don't. I remember going in at the beginning of the day, at least trying to look a little bit. But by the end of the challenge, I mean, having gone through that, some of the challenges are like 5-6 hours long. You're not looking at your best.
No, you always look very
tempted
fresh.
To put a bit of freeze-dried raspberry powder on just to pick up the colour.
So, just between us, what were the judges like in real life?
They were lovely. You didn't really have that much contact with them during the filming of the show. They were meant to definitely be biased. Mel and Sue, you saw a lot more of, and were just the most amazing pair. Really kept your spirits up. Yeah, Paul and Mary used to sort of come around. I remember the first week, though, because that was really a baptism of fire, thinking, what the hell have I done? This is so alien from my kitchen at home. And my workbench was just like an absolute mess. I was behind time. And I remember Mary coming up to my workbench and I was like, I'm so sorry, Mary. I feel I've let myself down. I've let you down. She was like, don't you worry, Frances. You can do this. And I remember thinking, Mary Berry thinks I can do this. Come on, Fran.
Yeah.
Pull it back, pull it back. But yeah, they were never able to give any advice. It's been much nicer now, say, meeting them at like food events or the good food shows and being able to chat far more because they're not
like
judging you
friends.
At that point. Yeah.
And Paul's
always like, you're too tall, Frances, because, you know, I'm 6 foot and like he's not over 6 foot. And I wasn't allowed to wear heels on the show, whereas I can
because
now.
Because of Paul?
Not because of Paul. I think just because of the fact that you're literally on your feet running around a tent.
Frances, moving on to the most important question of the day. What is your favourite sandwich?
Oh, dear. It depends if I'm making it like it's, you know, when you can go into a food place and you're like, well, I thought I wanted that, but I've seen that now. Like the whole food envy.
Yeah. The struggle is real.
The struggle is really real. Right now, I'm even thinking maybe a Reuben, but then the other side of me is thinking like a sort of hummus with loads of crunchy veg, sun-dried tomatoes.
Is that in a baguette?
No, I reckon it's in a really good sort of granary roll or wrap.
Yes.
Stuffed, or even a good pita bread.
That sounds like a very good option.
Yeah.
I think we'll allow you.
Or you'd want some, I don't know, a really good like sandwich platter.
Yeah, okay.
Sandwich cake, you know, so you can have
indecision. A girl
food indecision.
After my own heart. So did you have any disasters on the show? Did not go to plan?
A lot didn't go to plan. The one I think everyone remembers is obviously the biscuit tower collapse. So I think it was karma happening because that wasn't the bake I was intending to do. I was meant to do a gingerbread house of cards, which was going to feature a queen of tarts with Mary Berry, Paul Hollywood with like a bread knife, and the jokers were going to be Mel and Sue. But I don't know if anyone remembers, but I slightly got into hot water for whole cyanide substance, which I called SOS.
Yeah.
So I was like, right.
Yeah, Paul came to
Oh, yeah, that
time.
Became my catchphrase. So I was like, well, the Gingerbread House of Cards was just going to feature one type of biscuit, which was going to be gingerbread. And so I can't do that now. They're going to want something else different. So I was like, right, why don't I tap into my textile background? I'll do a whole, like, edible tower of biscuit buttons, bit like a haberdashery. It was meant to be like, look like a haberdashery box that had dropped and fallen over.
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of what I created.
Yeah, no, it is.
But it was just a crazy week. And I remember I'd run out of space on my workbench. And I remember actually taking over Kate Corner. And I remember Sue was like, Fran, you've taken over Mary Berry's table. I was like, I know, Sue, but I've got nowhere else to work. And it was a really hot day. Running out of time, and the whole thing that was meant to secure it was like this sort of sugar knitting needle, and I'd got a piece of doweling stuck in initially, and I remember Sue was like, Fran, you're gonna have to take that out because it all has to be edible. So a minute before the end, she was like, you're gonna have to replace it with the sugar knitting needle. And I remember taking out the doweling, putting in the sugar knitting needle, and I could feel and sense that it had broken.
No.
And then I remember Mel was like, that's it, bakers, step away from your creations. And I stepped away and the whole thing just went down and literally the whole tent went quiet. It was like some sort of out-of-body experience.
Oh, did your heart just
My
sink?
Heart just sank. And I remember going,
and then you had
to sit
with it for half an hour.
Yeah,
I remember
walking out of that tent and then they were like, Fran, can you come in and do your beauty shot? I was like, beauty shot? Beauty shot. I need like some sort of shot of like sugar or sort of to get over the shock. Yeah. That wasn't my best moment.
And but then, you bounced back, Fran.
I did bounce back.
You did. And that seems a good moment to ask you about your fifth Desert Island dish of the day. That's the dish that you eat the most often.
Do you know, it might be something really... I say plain and boring, but I don't think porridge does have to be plain and boring.
No.
But I pimp my porridge to the max.
Talk us through it.
Literally. Well, it depends on all the different milks that you can use. Like I love using like coconut or whatever else. And then I top it to the max because I love things with texture and bite. So it initially will have cinnamon on. I think I could do the cinnamon challenge and get through it because I sort
do
of...
Do you actually think... But I read the other day that you actually die if you have more than two teaspoons of cinnamon. Which
I think I should be dead then. I should be dead. Because could you like, do you want porridge with your cinnamon there, Fran? Literally, I like get, I should have shares in the stuff.
Well, Fran, I'll happily video you
should
doing
do it
the
now?
Cinnamon
should
challenge.
We do it now? Yeah. So, and I put like banana. So although it's really boring, that's what I eat the most of.
No, it's not boring at all.
At the moment.
Are you one of those people that believes in porridge for lunch or supper? Or do
oh,
you
we
only
can
have it
for breakfast? Anytime, yeah. Anytime.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So let's talk about what you're up to now. I'm always seeing the most incredible creations on your Instagram and it all just looks like business is booming. But what are you up to specifically and how's it all going?
Well, I am working on a second book at the moment.
Yay.
So yeah, it was sort of, it's interesting seeing the recipes that have done well in the first one. And the most popular one was like my Bourbon Brick Brownies, which was sort of taking a brownie, but then like adding in a bourbon biscuit.
Yum.
Because who doesn't love a bourbon?
Yeah.
So it's almost playing on that idea of taking much loved biscuits and pairing them with much loved bakes and creating things that don't necessarily have to take loads of time. Like I think a lot of people think, oh, Fran's bakes are sort of going to show stoppers that take hours. And I'm like, no, it honestly doesn't have to be like that.
Yeah.
Like when I did my banoffee Jenga shortbread, it's almost like saying, well, why does shortbread just have to be kept on a plate? Why don't we make it into a tower?
Yeah.
So it's sort of taking the idea of playing with your food, really. But it's great doing stuff. Like I've just done some stuff with the Design Museum. And then I'd done some things with the Tate for the Hockney exhibition in the summer. And I'm going to be doing some more stuff with them later on in the year with their new Impressionist exhibition. So I think because my design background, it sort of feeds into the food world.
Yeah.
And working with other brands, lots of things coming up. And Alex Munro, because I'm wearing
the
much loved bee necklace. And so I'm doing, because it's the brand's 30th anniversary this year, so I'm going to be doing a brunch with Alex as well next month.
So many exciting things going on. I've seen that you've been busy breaking world records. I wondered for you, what if you had to pick one thing, what's the most exciting thing that's happened?
Yeah, the giant Jaffa cake, that was pretty...
That was amazing.
Pretty impressive. And it's been great as well because I love music. So I've sort of done bakes for some of my favourite artists and bands. So I remember doing the giant club biscuit for Bombay Bicycle Club. And I did like a sweet Bombay mix that recipe featured in my first book. And it's just lovely hearing the band's reaction going, we love Bombay mix, but we've never had sweet Bombay mix.
Oh my goodness, that's so cool.
So it's been, yeah, it's great sort of doing stuff like that. I mean,
like things that you would just never have even thought of.
I never thought I'd make the shard out of gingerbread.
No, I can't believe
that.
I don't believe you did imagine that you'd do that growing up. No.
Making like Barbara Hepworth inspired sculptures out of shortbread, getting to meet heroes like Quentin Blake. So yeah, it's been a real sort of like smorgasbord of different things that, yeah, have happened along the way. Mad.
So great. Frances, what is your go-to dinner party dish? It's your sixth desert island dish of the day.
Oh, so is that something like I take along?
Or that you would make if you were entertaining people?
Sweet, sweet or savory. You see, I might say the Bourbon Brick Brownies.
Ooh, yes.
Just because, one, they're very good to travel with. So yep. If you were going, you know, particularly on like London Tube.
Also, I imagine you'd be a very popular guest if you brought those along.
They're just good because you can either leave them as they are or you can make a whole edible brick wall with them. And you can get everyone a bit interactive. So at the end of the meal, lay out a bowl of what looks like chocolate ganache, which is, but then it can become cement. And you can make a whole edible wall, or you
can just stack them up,
keep them warm, have ice cream on the side. I even did them once and used, there's white chocolate edible birthday candles in the book.
Yeah.
So simple, but they're good then if it's someone celebratory. So you can have white chocolate candles on a whole stack of brownies.
Wait, so how do you make an edible candle?
So simple.
Wow.
So a really quick way, if you want to melt chocolate. So if you get one of those disposable piping bags.
Yep.
Break up some white chocolate, although I have to say Milky Bar chocolate buttons, they're great chocolates to work with.
Good
tip. They don't split or whatever. So fill the piping bag with them. Don't obviously cut the end. Boil the kettle, fill up like a pint glass or a vase with hot water. Plunge the disposable piping bag with the white chocolate in. So the chocolate melts inside the bag. Once all the chocolate has melted, pull it out. Then cut the end, and then you can just get disposable drinking straws. Find the Waitrose one's the best. The Waitrose Cafe.
Oh, you are full.
Just take a few in your bag.
All the tips.
Cut them down to like sort of birthday candle size, and then just plunge them with the white chocolate. And because you've cut the end, they go in easy. And then if you put a little bit of desiccated coconut in the end, that acts as the wick. Let them go hard in the fridge. Then you just push them out the straw. Now, the desiccated coconut wick doesn't burn for long, but it does burn. It does burn.
Oh, my goodness. Whoever I know who has a birthday coming soon,
they're a great little gift. They're a great little gift.
That's so cool. So you are so creative, and I've heard you say that creativity is at the heart of everything you do. But how do you come up with these incredible ideas? Do they just sort of pop into your head in the middle of the night?
Honestly, that is the bit I love most, the ideas and the concepts. And yeah, they can come at 24/7. I sort of have a strange habit of seeing everything as food. So like even just like staring out at a brick wall, I'll just see similarities in texture between like a red brick and like maybe a gingerbread biscuit. Obviously soil, for me anyway, just looks like chocolate cake.
Was that a problem when you were a child? Or
stop eating the sand, she thinks it's chocolate biscuit crumbs. So ideas, and I think although all the designs I do are edible, the inspiration comes from outside of the kitchen. So whether it be architecture or music or a film or an exhibition. And also I am really guilty of playing with words and puns. So that will also naturally help me come up with a concept. So yeah, I just love it. I'd almost like to be a creative culinary conductor. Everyone's like, what the hell's that?
I feel like that's what you are. Mission accomplished. A huge tick.
Because sometimes the ideas come so quickly and I can't necessarily create them that quick. And it would almost be to work with a team where I'd be like, right, I need 5 meters of phyllo pastry. I need 2 liters of chocolate ganache.
Stat.
I remember Paul saying that you come into your own in the last 5 minutes when everything's done and it's like, blah, 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 blah. You can then just put it all together. It's like the conducting bit.
That's so, it, or like a surgeon.
So I'm going to maybe change that on LinkedIn.
Definitely. You've made your own title and I love that.
You want me for MI5 or creative culinary conducting? I'll bring a brownie.
So, Frances, I can't believe it, but we're on to the seventh and final desert island dish. And that is the last dish you would eat before being cast off to the desert island.
Again, I've got a problem on my hands. One thing says as simple as a coffee and a cinnamon bun.
There are no rules to this podcast, but Frances, no.
Okay.
I mean, you can have that as a starter.
A starter or,
come
or
on,
to end.
This is your last meal.
An all-you-can-eat buffet.
Yes, now
but
we're
the,
talking.
But the best sort, like, you know, somewhere like Ifos or Ottolenghi. Just go in there.
Oh, my goodness, yes, Ottolenghi.
Fill your plates with just Ottolenghi.
With no weight limit.
With no weight, yeah, no weight limit on the Ifos thing, definitely. And I even like it in, have you ever been to Ottolenghi's for breakfast?
No, I
they
haven't.
They put a toaster on your table. I mean, part of me is like, you're slightly doing the waiters.
Yeah.
I mean, you're just toasting your own bread, aren't you? But I just love the fact of, and they have so many different, like, pimped up Nutellas, you know, like chocolate spreads with whole hazelnuts in. So you just toast away, although you don't want to be on a table where you're having to share your toaster.
Oh, no.
That can get awkward if there's a couple and you have to keep going, excuse me.
Oh, yeah.
Could you just press my sourdough?
Yeah, that is an instance
not
of
good.
Sharing, not being caring.
But just being able to pile your plate high with all those incredible salads and dishes and, yeah, and to be able to move from different, like it is a melting pot in regards to the different types of food we've got access to now. So, and yeah, I'm always one for wanting to share food. So if you go out for a meal, I'm like, can we all get a different dish? But then you have to be with someone who's happy to do that. You don't want to be with a Joey.
I'm very much into that unless I've ordered better than everyone else.
True.
In which case I'm like,
yeah,
oh,
get
maybe
off my
we
Goyota.
Should just, maybe we should just have what we ordered.
Yeah, exactly. Food envy.
So, Frances, you're allowed to take one luxury item to the desert island. It can be anything. What are you going to choose?
It might even be the simple thing that's almost become a bit of my logo on my website. It's what's called the Spencil. So it's like a spoon and a pencil. So one end is the pencil so I could draw and illustrate all my ideas and the other end is a spoon. So I could, if I managed to forage and find anything, I could create something. But that's not that luxury, is it?
Well, that's okay. Luxury comes in many different forms.
Or just maybe something to listen to music, just so I can escape in that way. Yeah,
yeah.
An amazing playlist.
I'm going to be very generous and allow you both of those.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
No worries.
And there we are. How lovely is Frances? I'm so happy for her that such good and exciting things seem to be happening, as she just couldn't be nicer. And I feel she just really deserves it. I want to eat those brownies immediately, and she's also inspired me to cook up some flapjacks this weekend. I might even, if I'm feeling brave, give those edible white chocolate candles a go. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review in iTunes, and I will see you next time. Bye.